Welcome to Disruptive CEO Nation, where company founders, entrepreneurs, and cutting-edge thinkers drop in from around the globe to share startup stories, insider insights, and hard-earned success lessons. Now, here's your host, a woman who mastered business by placing heels on the ground all over the world, having worked with and coached CEOs and senior leaders from over 90 countries, and who wants you to build your best business future, Allison K. Summers.
Hey, everyone. Welcome to this episode of Disruptive CEO Nation. I am so grateful that you have given us the gift of your time, and hopefully we'll give you the gift of knowledge. We are heading to Saudi Arabia. I am so excited because we're speaking to one of the most influential Arab women, and she has gone from a media icon to an entrepreneur. We're going to talk about being a co-founder, lessons she's learned from business. So I would love to introduce you to Muna Abu Salaman. So welcome to the program. Tell everybody what wonderful things you do in the world.
Well, thank you so much for having me on this amazing podcast that I've heard so much about. So a lot of people know me from my TV show. It's just the number one TV show in the Arab world that deals with social issues. The only TV shows that make more money than we do are the kind of like American Idol types of shows. So it's a very interesting dynamic of having that background, but also actually being at heart somebody who loves doing international development. I was the head of the Al-Waleed Bin Talal Foundation for about 10 years, one of the largest foundations in the Arab world, as well as a serial entrepreneur. I think I am somebody who just loves taking ideas, analyzing them, and then bringing them to life, and hopefully making some money out of that.
Well, and I really do believe that entrepreneurs and business have played such a big role in international development. And of course, at Disruptive CEO Nation, we love social good. We love businesses as well as nonprofits that are doing something great in the world. Can you give the listeners an example of a project or an affiliation that you were extremely proud of?
I'm proud of almost everything that I do just because of that I'm very selective in the people that I mix with. I think that every business leader knows if you get the right people on the right bus, then things take off. And one of my criteria of working with people is that I feel that they're ethical and I actually feel comfortable in their presence. Now, it doesn't mean that we don't disagree. It just means that I feel comfortable. So even when we disagree, it doesn't become personal. It doesn't become something that actually festers. I am most proud, perhaps, of my work in the development area, in education. So in helping people who probably would not be able to realize their potential. And so this has led me to actually founding something called a small company called ADRI, with the co-founder and the CEO, Ali Mazra, from New Zealand. And the idea behind it, what really made me want to do it, is that for about 10 years, I was looking at the foundations of education in the Arab world. And one of them was that there's no transfer of knowledge from outside to the inside of the Arab world. There was a huge problem with translation of academic content, scholarly journals, just real information that allows people to build on research, development, and understand where the world is going beyond the newspaper headlines. And so we developed this company that allows for machine artificial intelligence translation. We can translate thousands of pages in 3 minutes, and then have a network of editors improve on our translation and give it at minimum price, really low price, to universities, schools, educational systems, journalists, and so that they can actually really work with up-to-date knowledge. So this is something that I'm very passionate about. And that took a very long time through many, many different reiterations until I found a for-profit model that would work and would enable people to invest in it. We had talked about this a little bit earlier. entrepreneurship in the and the social impact and the social good. There are two models, right? There's the model that says you need to actually be very benevolent and give aid and help people to actually just survive and become maybe lower middle class, and then you can go into the social entrepreneurship, which is probably the Muhammad Yunus, the microfinance type of organizations that we hear of, as well as Ashoka. And then you have the Omidar type of thinking, where it is like, no, if there's any social problem, the private sector can resolve it, and it should be for profit to incentivize the best ideas, the best people, and all these kind of dynamics to work and uplift people. And I think I fall in the middle, where I think some things can work for profit. I think like ADRI works for that. But then at the same time, I think there's so much need all over the world. And I'm not just talking about the developing world, but even in the US and in Europe, where we have homelessness and we have, you know, drug rehabilitation, where the private sector is not going to enable the kind of resources that are needed. There's just the resources will always needed will always be more than the resources that are given.
Yeah, that is absolutely true. The resources given are more than is needed. And I think I want to go back on something that you said. I do interview, I have some people I need to introduce you to who also work in this, you know, this machine learning place on dealing with document management, because I think it's so important. How do you feel at on Disruptive CEO Nation? We always talk about better business knowledge equals better business results. And you were talking about knowledge transfer on a massive scale. So tell us a little bit about your relationship with your co-founder, because this was such a big project when you originally launched it, and you have other experiences with co-founders. So tell us about that synergy to make this kind of project happen.
It's very interesting that you asked this question, because with co-founders, especially when you start something from the beginning, I didn't know my co-founder until we figured out that we share the same passion for the same reason. So it's very different than people that you grew up with or you worked with or you've had some relationships with, which is usually the way that you gather co-founders. With this particular co-founder, we didn't know each other, but we had a common mission. And I think that common mission and that real belief in the mission has enabled us to actually overcome a lot of the personality differences that we have. And we are very different. He's a computer scientist. He's very technical in certain things. He is personality-wise very different from me. And we had a little bit of trouble in the beginning gelling. But as I said, having that common purpose and really believing that this common purpose is what both of us really care about allows us to overcome. Now, I can tell you a little bit about co-founders that did not work with me, which is the majority of co-founders, right? You have problems. Usually there was an issue with the allocation of responsibilities, and it was usually when we were younger, didn't understand the importance of really ensuring that everybody is aligned on that. The second thing is people dropping out and expecting the same type of ownership. Contracts, expectations, KPIs, things are really important to set out in the beginning, and which I didn't in several of my first ventures. I would take people at their word, not realizing that this is actually part of the entrepreneurship journey. So having more legal resources available for very cheap to entrepreneurs is something important, to be able to draw the right contracts that fit different countries and different legal systems. Sometimes you guys come from different places.
Yeah.
This is not available, right? What you get is you get a guy who wrote a book about entrepreneurship saying, do it. But nobody actually then writes, where can you get it at dirt cheap prices that co-founders need,
Yeah, absolutely. Sorry, There's a couple things in there that you said that I think are so wonderful. And, you know, you can't just co-found a business on a handshake and a contract means so many things.
Your brother. Not even if it's your brother.
Yes. Absolutely. And I think this piece that comes through consistently when I speak with founders is about, you know, the legal aspect and the legal resources. And even if you can't hire a high-priced attorney, then get samples from your network. Pull samples from your network, because at least getting a duplicated contract in place from a good resource is better than nothing. And so I really love some of these pieces that you're bringing out, and about the mission and the KPIs. What else with the founder would you give somebody for advice when you're starting down that path with your co-founder?
I think also one of the most difficult things is how much some people get wedded to the original idea or the original prototype, and it takes a lot of you know, soul searching to move on. And sometimes people hold on too long and it ruins the business. And so this kind of constant communication between co-founders about what's working, what's not working, and where is the thinking leading. So you don't want to surprise your co-founder, like suddenly when they say, we need to switch to this. They may not have gone on the same journey as you have. In the switch, and the switch may not work, right? You might need to change it again. And so these are like some of the difficulties of entrepreneurship that nobody really talks about, this kind of emotional attachment that you have towards a product, towards an idea, towards a concept, and having 3, 4, 5 people actually also change with you regarding that concept. And there's a lot of anger that comes in. I think there's some very, you know, famous examples is it Apple, where there were 3 people, Steve Jobs, Steve Wozniak, and a 3rd person. And that 3rd person like suddenly realized how much money and all these kind of things that, and the kind of mess that they're going to get into before they actually get a project. And he just pulled out, right? Disastrously for him. But this is it. Like you kind of have to, like, the wavelength. You have to kind of ride the same wavelength together. And the only way you can do it is by constantly communicating doubts, issues, ideas that come up, and not say, well, last week you had a different idea and that didn't work out. Kind of like really allow people to be honest and vulnerable and bring out all of the different facets to an issue that they're seeing, whether it takes you somewhere together or it doesn't, but there has to be that kind of space. And I don't know, I think maybe women, like I've noticed with women co-founders, we're a little bit more open about these things, whereas male co-founders kind of like pretend things are like really working okay.
I'm reminded of a quote from Francisco Weber, who is with Cortical IO, and his number one advice for founders was, don't believe your own bullshit. And he's like, you know, you need to be honest about what you do well, and you need to be honest about what you don't. He goes, because the energy around keeping up a false front is just way too great. And it affects everything. So I think you're right on these pieces. So
I'll tell you something else that I do, which I think because I'm also a social impact investor. So I invest and sometimes, you know, as a silent investor. So I don't actually get involved in any of the operations of a company. And so as an investor, what I've done, which I heard somebody say in some kind of setting, I think it was a panel, and I just took it really to heart. I try to visit the entrepreneurs in their place of action, whatever it is, if it's a home, if it's a garage, if it's, you know, a co-working space, wherever they're at, 6 times.
Wow.
Because the first time and the second time, they kind of like have everything, like, together, right? They kind of like have a story and a narrative, and they're telling it to me. And the second time they're telling it to me, and maybe there's just a small bit of a crack, or like there's a bit. The third time they get comfortable with you, and then they talk a little bit more honestly. The fourth time you start seeing the issues that were highlighted in the third meeting actually manifests in the way that they're working together. And by the sixth time, you kind of know whether these co-founders have what it takes to take that idea and really succeed with it. So by the sixth meeting, you kind of know whether the co-founders' problems are workable, whether they will be able to, or this will become a toxic type of environment. And the reason is, I used to do one, sometimes like two maximum, and make a decision. But I found that this idea of really becoming a little bit more intimate with them has helped me resolve a lot of issues that I had found later on, like a year or two later on in the investment. One of them is that sometimes one of the co-founders is actually not there. So I like to have at least three co-founders personally. I found that the, you know, they'd be like, they were not even part-time. They were moving on to a new position or somewhere else. And these are the things that you don't realize until people start talking about it. And it's an extremely important part of the criteria for my evaluation. I don't like one-man show or two-man show, because sometimes when it's two, at the stage that I invest in, the, you know, split in decisions, it becomes very difficult to manage.
Well, I think that's interesting. And I think before we started this interview, for me, that then also translates to this concept of the pressure on the founder. And I think there's a couple different aspects and dynamics, because in modern business today, and depending on what country you're in and your culture, you know, sometimes this founder is kind of glorified, or they're expected to be the be-all social media presence, or so you've done this evaluation of these founders. And like you said, it takes a bit to identify the cracks, or if they can be in it for the long haul. But what are your thoughts and perspectives on the pressure on this founder or the CEO?
So it's very important to realize that the media has done a huge disservice to entrepreneurs, where they build them up to be wonder kids at early stages of their lives. Yeah. And what that happens is that it switches their attention from thinking about their real stakeholders, their clients, their investors, into this public image of who they are, right? They need to live up to this public image of being somebody who's successful. And then if that person doesn't have enough experience, if they're not emotionally have a lot of resources and support, that actually can destroy them. And you see them spiraling. And, you know, when I hear these stories about the entrepreneurs who, you know, become have the bro culture, or they are perhaps doing you know, unhealthy habits, part of it is that they were pushed in. Entrepreneurship is already difficult enough. Starting a business is difficult enough. It is a pressure cooker, and then you add this whole Instagram, Snapchat media attention to it, and it becomes a bomb, a ticking bomb. At the same time, you need media, right? You need media to actually bring attention to a certain product. You need celebrities to see them. So it is a double-edged sword that it's really, but the onus is really on the media companies to be a little bit more level-headed when they're discussing entrepreneurship. So one of the things I don't like is the 30 under 30, right?
Ah, interesting perspective.
I don't mind 40 under 40. You have a lot of experiences, but 30 under 30, you're getting like a 22-year-old who just graduated from college, who maybe had like an interesting idea in Berkeley or Stanford or, you know, in Seattle or whatever, and starts doing it. And he has the network because he went to these universities to enable him to actually spread it. And then the media loves this idea of wonder kids, right? Because we love this idea of that our educational system is working, that our that if you're, you know, if it's not about privilege, but it's about your ideas. Look at this 22-year-old who's able to, you know, get to where he is at just by his ideas or his brain power. And then at 25, you find that person is like totally burnt out because he has to keep up. What was it that Frank said? The bullshit?
Yeah. Has to keep it up. Yeah.
Of the appearances of being successful. And we all know that there is no way you would have been successful for 5 years as an entrepreneur, that there were a lot of sleepless nights, that there was a lot of times that your cash flow was extremely, you know, difficult to manage, that clients had issues with your products, that you got. So we have to be a little bit more realistic. And I think the media, and also because I do work in the media and I try not to participate in it, but sometimes, you know, that you can see how the momentum builds, right? One person writes about it in a local newspaper, then it gets picked up by a magazine, then a celebrity talks about it, and then suddenly they're on the Wall Street Journal or Forbes. And we keep doing this, like every week is the same cycle. You can just see it, you can trace it. And I think we have to be a little bit more aware of it, and we have to be a little bit more level-headed.
Yeah, I think that's really great advice. And, you know, I'm thinking of, I've had over 3 years of interviewing people now, and the ones that I really see hit their mark and scale fast are really those individuals who had some solid corporate experience underneath them. And it's not saying that I haven't seen, you know, the opposite, because I can think of some really great entrepreneurs that started very young in life, but they scaled a little slower.
They're not the norm.
The average age
of successful entrepreneur is over 45, I think, or 40. That's 45. Somebody who has gone through the corporate culture, who has worked different jobs, who understands supply chain. I always, like with my kids, I say, always learn with somebody else's money.
Yes. Yes, exactly. Somebody else's time, somebody else's money, somebody else's resources. I want to go back and tap on this fact, because we said to our listeners when we introduced you, and we've also just kind of talked about media, but that you were a media icon, and you know, and you yourself said that you want to take a little bit of the focus off of yourself and put it more on the actual mission and the work of the projects that you're doing. Can you talk a little bit about personal transformation and you as a leader, and what led you to some of those decisions to make those, you know, life transitions?
So it's very interesting. I mean, I became a media icon kind of by accident. I'm an extreme introvert, which most people can't imagine, but I am. I'm somebody who is very at home in the academic world, in you know, in that kind of setting where you're discussing ideas, and you kind of people know you by your writing versus by what you look like or what you are wearing. And what happened was, 20 years ago in the Arab world, women didn't have as many opportunities as they do right now. There's been a huge transformation, especially in Saudi Arabia. I think people read about it all the time. Mm-hmm. The legal reforms for women, the changes, the opportunities, the government actually powerfully pushing for female empowerment. And so at the time that I started media, it was one of the very few ways for women to get power, to be seen, to be treated as equal. And so when the chance came, I took it for that reason. I realized it's a chance that I could actually push forward some of my personal convictions and agendas. And it did. You know, the show gave me a huge platform, and I'm very happy to be part of the transformation or setting some of the foundations for it. But what happened was, like those entrepreneurs that burnt out, it was so not me. I had to like live the bullshit. day in and day out, and people knowing so much about my life. And, you know, because you use your life to show examples, like with your children, to show people that it's not just them, it is everybody's problem and how to solve it. And so the minute that I felt that the Arab world has moved to a different level, where we will not see our rights taken away. Mm-hmm. We have, as they say, we reached the threshold, right? I actually quit the show, and the show is still going on. I quit about 3 years ago because I felt that what I wanted to do, my mission was accomplished, and it was never really about being on TV, and I, if you see my presence on social media, it is extremely low, just, you know, making sure that I have, I love Twitter. If anybody wants to follow me, go to Twitter. That's where I'm at most of the time, because I love writing a lot more than I love, and I love the condensation of condensing ideas into 280 characters. That takes a lot of, brevity takes a lot more work than, you know, long prose forms. And so that was the first transformation. I left the media world because I didn't think I'm needed anymore. There's so many changes that have happened. And I really concentrated on a couple of things that I really loved, which is how to make sure that journalists are accountable, how to help journalists get the stories right. And we do this with Medan.com and Medan Labs, which is based out of San Francisco, and the CEO is Advice, an amazing, amazing human being who loves building infrastructures for the internet that allows transparency and the ability to verify information. Mm-hmm. And then also to ADRI, which is, again, building the foundational knowledge for the Arab students all over the world at extremely cheap prices, something that I worked on and off for since 2007, but which the reiteration of it that is now ADRI was in 2016. And then my latest venture, which was COVID-related, is extremely funny. I'll have to tell you about the story. So in 2019, I had decided that I'm going to take a year off for learning. And I understand most people would love to do this. I was able to have that chance. And I had planned the whole year with every month, either an executive education or an interesting experience that is out of my comfort zone, so that I would be learning for 12 months. And you know, attending interesting conferences all over the world on things that I don't know much about, so that I would understand where the 21st century is really going. Mm-hmm. We all read the news, and we all, you know, read The Economist, and we're all reading, you know, Vanity Fair. And so you kind of like get a gist, but I really wanted to go with the experts. And I love conferences because people,
I'm just going to laugh because I take vacation to go to business conferences and people think I'm crazy.
No, it's like the best thing in the world, because you have these experts who are very yes. confident in their own knowledge, debating the most interesting ideas with like information and data and all these kind of things. And it's not like the BS that you see on news cycles, where they're getting the most controversial people or whatever for sensationalist news. These are the real experts. So I go to these things and I learn. And I had decided that all year. And so January, I think I did a cutting edge economics course at Harvard. I did in February this very interesting spiritual journey for the YPO, which is the Young President's Organization in Oman. And it was one of those like mind-blowing. They brought like masters from all over the world in things that I had no knowledge of. And then in March, I was going for a Google type conference for change makers. And I arrive in Portugal. And they're like, everything is going to close down. You better come back to Saudi Arabia. And I go back to Saudi Arabia. And within like days, I'm talking to experts. And everybody that I knew said, it's going to be like a year. Just mm-hmm. understand. So I was like, okay, I need to pull out of all my learning journeys. It was like so heartbreaking, right? This whole year that I had planned. I planned this beautiful, beautiful year as my midlife crisis.
Your midlife crisis, personal sabbatical.
And so in around March, when I came back, I started looking for friends who were working on COVID just to understand what they're doing. And a friend of mine, Mustafa Mokas, was working on something called COVID Pass, which became Health Tech Key. And this is a revolutionary idea. I mean, everybody's doing health passports, right?
Yes.
What we did was, we're like, there's going to be a lot. We know every entrepreneur, every good business leader knows that there is certain human behaviors that are ingrained and that will happen. And so some of them are bad. And one of them, we know people will cheat. We didn't realize the anti-vaxxers or these kind of, movements, but we were thinking that even people who believed in everything about COVID, if they want to go see somebody, they're going to, and they can't get a positive a negative test, they might lie, or they don't have time, or it's too expensive to do, or whatever, there's going to be a significant proportion of people traveling all over the world and within countries who are not going to be honest about their tests. So what we did was we went in and we had already through another company that Mustafa owns a huge network of labs that we had UI audit to ensure mm-hmm. that the machines, the people that are there are who they are and who they say they are. And we installed our software in them to ensure that everybody who says or is getting on an airplane and says I was negative or I had this vaccine or whatever, it is exactly what they said. And so to lower the fraud in international travel. And we're already operational in several countries, Iraq, Kuwait, we're signing with Indonesia, we're working in the US, hopefully with STC, and looking at ways of saying this virus or other viruses are gonna be parts of our lives. And we have to make sure that we don't take people at their word because there's going to be people who will lie.
There absolutely are. Come to the United States and we know that's true. And I think, you know, I'll say this. I was just in Germany. I just traveled to Germany for business and I was so excited to get on an airplane and use my passport. It was like so exciting. And I think what you're saying, because one, as a civil society, we need this international travel. We need the movement as a global economy that's interdependent. We need this movement.
We need movement and we need to trust that this movement will be virus, whether it's COVID or other things, free. We have to have that in order to live our lives normally.
Well, tell our listeners again, what is this company?
So it's called Health Tech Key.
Okay.
And you're going to be hearing a lot of great news coming out in the press release through media very soon. But it's really the only, I mean, there's other people now that are doing the labs, but their labs are not verified. People will still be able to pay bribes in certain countries to get the testing or and not pay, you know, because a lot of, in some countries, it's actually quite expensive and people mm-hmm. will not be able to afford for people to travel with the PCR test costs. In some places, it's $150 per person, right? So it's like $700, $800. You're just not going to put that in to travel from one place to another. And I hope that people who are interested in, if they want their lab networks to join ours, to contact me. I'm on Twitter, please send me a message. Or if certain events companies or places that really want to ensure that every single person that comes through to their place of business actually is 100% verified, please contact us as well. This is an exciting business opportunity, but I started it because I realized that I had put everything in my life in 2019 and I had a year.
So you needed a new project.
I just couldn't sit at home, do nothing.
Well, we could ask you so many more questions, but we're actually at our time. And so I'm going to close with this. I like to ask my guests and you have your interest and your fingers into so many different things. But if we came back and spoke with you in another 3 years, what do you hope the story is? What do you hope for you personally or for any of your projects that you hope is the story down the road?
So there's several things that I think are important for my projects. I think with Health Tech Key, it's going to be that we are really feeling safe in traveling and going to universities and going to schools without this idea of constant third rolling and fourth rolling of vaccines. You can actually mm-hmm. know whether you are at risk or not just by having a test, and that works out well and travel goes back to normal and the economic development of, you know, so many countries that has been severely affected actually ends because it's, you know, only 3% of all Africans are vaccinated right now and their economy is decimated in so many places. It's just heartbreaking. So I would love for that to work and help resolve that part of the global problem for this company. On a personal level, what I would love to see is more VCs investing appropriate amounts of money in female-led businesses or businesses that deal with female issues. We have a lot of press on some, you know, like the think panties or, you know, the Spanx or things like that. But I think there's so many different solutions that are coming up from females that are not being funded, that are not being funded enough. And that the VCs that everybody's talking about that are, you know, geared towards women are just not enough for all these amazing women, amazing ideas, and amazing businesses that deal with female challenges or female points of view, whether they are led by a female or not. So this, personally for me, is a very important step for empowerment, having the financial resources for female-centric and centered ideas to flourish.
I think that is fantastic. And I like to talk to, I talk to a lot of female entrepreneurs coming up in various aspects of the tech space. And it is difficult to listen to sometimes the amount of pitches they have to do to get to their level of being fully funded or, you know, just different hoops they have to go through. And so I love that as your personal goal. I'll support that one as well. Well, it has been absolutely delightful to speak with you. Tell people again how to reach out to you and connect with you if they want to follow you or learn more information.
So if you look at the spelling of my name, that is exactly the spelling of my name for my Twitter handle and my last name. So I'm at Abu Sulaiman, at Abu Sulaiman. And the best way of connecting with me is through Twitter and also LinkedIn. I'm there in LinkedIn. If you have a VC that would love to support one of my projects, whether or a foundation that would love to support one of my projects about education in Africa and the Arab world, please connect to me. If you're somebody who's from the Arab world and need a little bit of mentorship, I'd be happy to either help or guide you towards somebody who can help you.
Thank you so much. And to our listeners, if there was something that was interesting in this interview that you think somebody else needs to hear, please pass it along. As always, we really appreciate if you give us a positive review. Head over to Podchaser or go to your favorite podcast site. And if there is a disruptive or innovative CEO that you think we need to be speaking to, send me a note at connect@alisonksummers.com. Until then, keep your eye on the future. Muna, thank you again for being such a wonderful guest.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed the interview. It's always lovely to have somebody who shares a lot of the same ethos.
Thank you.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.